slaves did not see the money, of course, but if I had a chance to work away from the prying eyes of Madam, I'd be grateful for it. Yes, sir, I lied. We need a maid to clean out the cells. Dying men do puke out some terrible things, they do. You're a steadfast girl. Tell your mistress we pay her the going rate for your services.
I shall tell her, sir.
He shouldered his rifle. I'm on the night watch now. The name is Fisher. Bring me round some cake, and I'll keep an eye on your brother.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher, sir. I shall.
No kidney pie, though. Kidney sour my gut. Something terrible.
The master left for London with much muttering on the part of his wife. She did not take to her bed as I expected, but was driven round to the home of Mrs. Taylor to play cards, and no doubt complain about her husband. While she was gone, Sarah birthed her baby boy in the cellar. I was so tempted to sneak down the stairs and watch. I'd seen kittens and calves come into the world, but not babies. I had a powerful curiosity about it, but I dared not. I kept water boiling for the midwife and stuck cloth in my ears to keep out the noise. When Sarah stopped hollering, I crept down the stairs to see the babe. He was a round-headed fat fellow with big eyes and bigger ears.
George, Sarah called him.
You named him after the king? Hannah asked.
Perhaps, Sarah said cheerfully. We've never figured the colonists would hold on this long. My man was saying the other night that maybe the king should stop the war. Maybe the babe and us might stay here, not sail home.
Plenty of room here, he said. She kissed the baby's nose. A name like George is a good one on either side of the ocean.
Shh, warned Mary.
The next day, Sarah and her George moved to a house set aside for new mothers attached to the army. I was sad to see them go, for I had wanted to hold the little one and make him laugh. Lady Seymour wanted to hear all of the details about the new baby. I thought maybe I could visit Sarah and ask her to bring the little lad by. Something about a baby always brings old folks back to life. When I mentioned this notion to the lady, she just shook her head.
Not until this pestilence has left my lungs.
She coughed into a stained handkerchief.
Heaven knows when that will be.
Her health was changeable and flighty. One day she'd feel strong and lively and she'd eat three meals and drink a gallon of tea. The next she'd lie abed with fever, looking so poorly it tempted Madam to order the coffin made. I went to place another log on the fire. Lady Seymour was lying propped up on pillows in her bed. She shook her head.
No more wood. I am warm enough. Please sit down, Isabel.
Ma'am?
I would like you to sit down, either in the chair or on the edge of the bed. I should like to talk to you.
It was improper for a servant to sit with a lady as though they were companions, but she asked me direct, so I sat myself in the chair that was close to the fire. I could not figure what we needed to conversate on. She hadn't sent me for a newspaper or sweets for days and days. Had I displeased her?
Thank you.
She sat back and used her right hand to place her left hand in her lap.
I will soon meet my Maker, Isabel. I am a sinner in need of forgiveness.
I relaxed. 'Twas the pull of death that made old people go funny. Miss Mary Finch went the same way toward the end. Clouds would roll into her eyes, and she would talk nonsense for hours. Me and Ruth just sat polite and listened. The trick with addled old folks was to be agreeable.
We all seek forgiveness, Lady Seymour. I wanted to buy you, she said. I wasn't sure I heard that right. Beg pardon, ma'am? I tried to buy you from Anne after I first met you. She refused, and we argued like a pair of fishwives. I rather lost my temper, she chuckled. Hadn't done that for 30 years. I knew not what to say.
She studied her useless hand.
When Elihu returned from exile, I should have demanded you be placed in my household. I was horrified by your treatment, and, of course, your poor sister. But then the fire.
Her gaze returned to the hearth.
I regret I did not force the matter. You would have suited my household.
It would have eased her mind if I had thanked her for wanting to buy me away from Madam. I tried to be grateful, but could not.
A body does not like being bought and sold like a basket of eggs, even if the person who cracks the shells is kind.
Isabel?
She awaited some word from me. I did not know how to explain myself. It was like talking to her maid, Angelica, who was so much like me and at the same time, so much different. We two had no string of words that could tie us together.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for telling me this.
That was all I could muster.
Forgive me, she said. I'm a clumsy old woman.
There was a shout from the drawing room upstairs, where Colonel Hawkins and his men had been meeting. I stood. The soldier wives are all visiting Sarah. I should...
Go on, she said, closing her eyes.
Colonel Hawkins was in a right foul mood on account of all the forms he had to fill out and reports that were late. The war seemed fought with as much paper as bullets. What with the letters and the passes and permissions piled on the table, orders received and recorded, recordings of conferences noted down. When I entered, he hollered that the room was colder than a barn and called me all manner of rude names. I chose the wood for his fire very carefully. The greenest, dampest logs in the entire woodpile, guaranteed to smolder and sputter without giving off any heat and even less light. After a frigid hour, he left for headquarters. It took all my might not to crack a smile. The grandfather clock ticked off the minutes. Madam would not return home for a goodly while. She was a terrible card player, but she had loads of money to lose, so her companions would keep her at the faro table as long as possible. I peeked at Lady Seymour's door. She was wrapped up in her coverlet and sleeping. The blankets barely moved when she took breath. I pulled out Common Sense from its hiding place and read by firelight. In truth, there were some pages that I jumped over, for I found it hard to figure their meaning. But I gathered many of his thoughts. Americans had good cause to overthrow their British masters. A person born to wealth was not born to rule over others, and 'twas good and proper to fight injustice. I kept the mending basket close to hand, in case I needed to hide my crime.
Chapter 41, Tuesday, January 7th through Wednesday, January 15th, 1777. It is not in the power of the smiles or frowns of Her Majesty to affect me either by conferring pleasure or giving pain. I was wholly incapable of taking the place she seemed to assign me when I was presented to her. I suppose she assented to the assertions that there were no people who had so much impudence as the Americans, for there was not any people bred even at courts who had so much confidence as the Americans. This was because they did not tremble, cringe, and fear in the presence of majesty. Nabby Adams, daughter of Abigail and John Adams, on meeting Queen Charlotte of England. When Madam woke the next morn, her first command was for hot scones. Her second was that the seamstress must be fetched immediately. The British Commandant was throwing a ball in honor of Queen Charlotte's birthday in 10 days' time. Madam required a new gown for such an occasion, perhaps two. I learnt of all of this when I returned from the market with a fresh killed chicken. Hannah, who had taken over the boss lady job from Sarah after the baby was born, was preparing a cherry pie. Mary sat by the window, mending one of Madam's skirts. The notion of a ball for a queen confuddled me. "That's a long voyage for a celebration," I said. Hannah laughed. "No, you ninny. The queen isn't coming. How could she? She's got 10 children to take care of, plus all them castles."
11, added Mary. "She popped out a new one last spring.
Even though the queen can't come, the officers always hold a ball in her honor," Hannah said as she rolled out the pie dough. "Gives them a good excuse to eat too much, drink too much, and make proper fools of themselves whilst dancing."
I pulled out the feather bag and a basin.
"And Madame Lockton is attending?"
"The colonel will be her escort." Mary bit her thread in two. "All the rich folks will be there." I ripped a handful of feathers from the chicken and stuffed them in the bag. "Does Madame require anything of us?"
"Not yet," Hannah said, carefully laying the dough in the pie plate. "That will change, no doubt."
"I seen the queen herself, you know," Mary said, squinting at her stitches.
"With your own eyes?" asked Hannah.
"I don't believe you."
"Well, I seen her carriage, and she was in it. The backside of the carriage, mine. Actually, the backside of the troops guarding the backside of the carriage.
but I saw the wheels bent down to do it. She threaded another needle. Bet you don't know her name.
Her Majesty, said Hannah.
Proves you're not a Londoner, Mary said. Her proper name is Her Majesty Queen Charlotte of Great Britain, Duchess Sophia Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz.
How do you remember all them names when you can't remember from one minute to the next how much salt goes into the biscuits?
Asked Hannah. Biscuits are not as important as the Queen. I practiced her name from the time I was a girl, case the day ever come when she saw me on the street and I could call out her entire gracious name. If I did that, her carriage would stop, and she'd make me a lady-in-waiting on account of my good manners.
There was a moment of silence while the two women considered this,
then a loud outburst as they near fell over themselves in laughter.
After dinner, Lady Seymour had a frightful seizure of the apoplexy. Looked just like one of Ruth's fits, except not with so much shaking. She fell into a sleep so deep I thought she was stone dead. But every so often, she'd take a breath, and once she opened her eyes. When she woke the next morning, she could not speak nor move her legs. Dr. DeStooge arrived and bled her and stuck pins in her limbs and gave her a bit of tea. In truth, there was nothing could make her better. I was told to tend her again, as I had right after the fire. I fed her and held the teacup to her lips and wiped her chin when she dribbled and helped her with the chamber pot business. This last was most distressing for her, and she cried. Then I wiped the tears from her face.
I heard Madam ask the doctor plain when the old lady would die.
The doctor could not answer her.
I figured Madam wanted Lady Seymour to die as soon as possible, but not before the Queen's ball. If the house was in mourning, it wouldn't be proper for Madam to dance with the Admiral and make merry.
A week before the ball, Madam ordered that Lady Seymour be moved to the parlor bedchamber downstairs so she could reclaim the largest bedchamber for herself. After two privates had carried the lady down and she was propped up on her pillow so she could look out the window, Madam called me upstairs.
I want this room aired and the linens boiled, girl. It smells of decay in here.
The work of the day was simple and heavy. Strip the bed, haul down the linens for to wash, clean out the hearth, open the windows and wash them inside and out, take the rugs down and beat them in the yard, sweep and mop the floor, take the rugs back in, close the windows, and give all the wood a polish. When the chamber was clean, Madam told me to open the windows again and let them stand open all afternoon to make sure there was no lingering pestilence in the air. I did as I was told. The doctor came right before supper and gave Lady Seymour a potion that would make the night pass quickly for her. When she was ready for bed, Madam called for me to bring up a warming pan filled with coals and run it between the sheets because they were chilled and still a wee bit damp. I did what she asked, then returned to the kitchen, dumped the coals in the hearth, and crept under my own blanket. She called for me again. The sheets were still too cold for her liking. I refilled the warming pan, carried it up the stairs, and warmed her bed. Then I stoked the fire in her hearth before returning down the stairs. The third time she called for me, I was sore tempted to dump the glowing coals onto her bed, let it blaze, and ask if that was warm enough. But I did not. I performed the task she gave me, and when she called a quarter hour later, I did it again. The sun rose bright the next day, catching in the icicles that hung from the eaves and jumping off the snow like a mirror. The linens pegged out on the line were froze stiff as wood and covered in a lacework of ice. The clouds scuttled away and the sun blazed, turning the yard into a garden of jewels. Ruth would love this. If we were free and at home in Rhode Island, and these were our sheets and our laundry lines and our snow, she'd dance like an angel. The pictures in my brain pan caught me by surprise. I could not clear them away. She'd clap her hands at the sight of the frozen laundry. She'd twirl in the spinning swirls of snow that lifted in the breeze. She'd plunge her hands into the bushes to pluck off the diamonds. She would do all these things and laugh and... The wind tossed a handful of snow in my face and washed it all away. Ruth would not see this. Never. I dried my face. Why was I thinking of Ruth? I'd worked hard to pack her away from my mind, along with the thoughts of Mama and Papa and the life Ruth and I were promised.
didn't help to ponder things that were forever gone. It only made her body restless and fill up with bees all wanting to sting something. I kicked at the new snow. It rose up, a sparkling diamond breeze fit for a queen. 'Twas Lady Seymour who did it. Her with her begging forgiveness for not buying me and telling me I'd have been a good slave for her. Her with her wet eyes and skeleton hands. Did she never think about setting me free? That would be a fine question to ask. Course, there was no sense to asking it because her mouth didn't work anymore. I carried the big laundry basket out to the sheets. I'd have to hang them in the kitchen else they wouldn't dry till spring. Another picture hung itself in my mind. The poetry book in the stationer's shop. The one I'd been afraid to read. Miss Phyllis Wheatley went free when her master released her. 'Twas on account of her fame, Mama said. Master Wheatley looked the fool for keeping a poetical genius enslaved in his household. I'd heard of other slaves who bought their freedom, folks who were given their Sunday afternoons to work for themselves, who saved their pennies and farthings for years and years until they had piled up the 150 or 200 pounds to buy their body and soul from their master. If I had Sunday afternoons free, I'd figure a way to earn my pennies. I could sew or hire out to scrub stables. I'd even clean the cells of the bride well, like that guard asked. I took a long stick from the pile of kindling wood. It would never happen. Madam would not allow it. She was set on keeping my arms and legs dancing to her tune and my soul bound in her chains. I pulled the stick back and cracked it against the side of the frozen bed linen. The ice shattered and fell to the ground, tinkling like pieces of fallen stars. Chapter 42. Thursday, January 16th through Saturday, January 18th, 1777. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Declaration of Independence of the United States of America. Dr. Destouge visited Lady Seymour each morning and eve. She could nod her head yes and shake it no to his questions. Yes, she knew who she was. No, she had no sensation in her feet nor her hands. She could barely chew milk-soaked bread and sip broth. Her mind had not gone soft, though. Her eyes blazed bright in her skull and followed me as I moved around the room, and when the doctor and madam talked, she listened in right close. Plainly said, she was as much a prisoner in her broken body as Corzin was in his cell. Madam Seamstress came near as frequent as the doctor. The birthday ball gown had a scarlet-red underskirt topped with a short gown of royal navy blue, embroidered with gold. The hairdresser and madam spent hours consulting prints of fashionable ladies in Paris so that they could design a suitable hairstyle. I was not privy to the details, but I heard madam talking about jewels made of paste that would sit in her curls. She also wanted a small British flag to fly atop her locks, but the hairdresser talked her out of it. Hannah and Mary talked about the ball every waking minute. I'm sure even the Queen herself would have grown tired of hearing about it. At noon, the guns at the battery, which the British had taken to calling Fort George, would fire a royal salute. An hour later, the warships in the harbor would blast a response. At 6 o'clock, the guests would arrive at the ball, with trumpets playing and drums beating a welcome. The dancing would last until midnight, when the fireworks would explode over the harbor. After that, the banquet would begin. There was no way under heaven that Madame would survive 6 hours of dancing without having something to eat. I finished reading Common Sense the night before the ball. The bookseller was right. The words were dangerous, every one of them. I ought to throw it in the fire, but could not bring myself to do it. Mr. Payne knew how to stir up the pot. He went right after the king and attacked the crown on his head. I laid down one long road of a sentence in my memory. For all men being originally equals, no one by birth could have a right to set up his own family in perpetual preference to all others forever. Way I saw it, Mr. Payne was saying all people were the same, that no one deserved a crown or was born to be higher than another. That's why America could make its own freedom. 'Twas a wonder the book did not explode into flames in my hands. I buried it back in its hidey hole and laid myself down to sleep. My eyes would not close. my thoughts were churned up like muddy water with dangerous eels thrashing through it. If the entire nation could seek its freedom, why not a girl? And if a girl was to seek her freedom, how could she do such a fool-headed thing, especially a girl trapped in New York? Best thing would be to break into the desk of a British commander, steal a pass, and forge her name and his name on it, and act free. And pigs were likely to fly, too. Plus, that girl seeking freedom would have to walk. She could walk the mile from Wall Street to the north edge of the city, but then she'd run into the guards stationed there. She'd have to sneak past them and not get shot. Then she'd have 11 miles of running to the north edge of the island. If she took the Greenwich Road or the Post Road, she'd likely be captured by one in need of a slave or in need of the reward paid for a healthy runaway. If she stuck to the woods that ran at the center of the island, she could be ate by a bear or drowned in a swamp. If angels guided her safe through the woods and she made the north edge, she'd have to get past the guards watching over King's Bridge when New York Island touched the rest of America. I rolled over, my back to the fire. That girl could more likely grab hold of the feet of a passing crow and bid him fly her to safety. Better yet, sprout her own wings. The only path left was across the water. A girl like that could not swim and did not own a boat. Not to mention the river currents were fast and the crossing would be noted by someone who would raise a ruckus, and then the soldiers would line up like a firing squad and shoot that girl dead in the water. They wouldn't even bury her proper. Just let the water take the boat and the body, and both would be consumed by sea monsters. I fell asleep cursing them that planted the city of New York on an island. My dawn visits up the commons had become the most ordinary of errands. Madam never woke early enough to note my absence, and the soldier wives were so grateful to avoid the chore, they never told. Corzin had grown terrible thin and was still feverish, but his leg had healed up, and he greeted me at the window every day. After I left the prison, I'd fetch the water and head back to Wall Street, passing by the Golden Hill Tavern in case Captain Morse needed me, which he never ever did. So when the captain signaled me from the tavern porch the next morning, I was surprised. I had not seen him for weeks, not since the news of the rebel victory at Trenton. "Good day, Giselle," he said with a sleepy smile. "How do you fare?" "Good enough, sir," I said. "Is something amiss?" He winced and pulled his coat tighter. "Nothing grave. No news of battle or prisoner exchange." I waited while he sought the words. "I'm in need of a favor," he finally said. "It's of no worldly import, but it is a matter of honor for me."
"Sir?"
"I must repay a debt, Giselle. I wagered Captain William Farrar that the British would not dare hold this ridiculous birthday celebration. It's a slap in the face to the people who are starving."
"Yes, sir."
He frowned and kicked at a stone poking up from the half-frozen mud. "But I'm proven wrong, aren't I? Thousands of pounds are being wasted, and so I owe my friend, Captain Farrar, a penny. A gentleman always pays his debts promptly, be they large or small."
I was confuddled.
"And you want that I should..." He threw up his hands in frustration. "The British have confined all American soldiers to their lodging houses today."
"Why?"
"They fear we might mount an insurrection while they are dancing minuets and gorging on stuffed goose. They have a point. The ball would provide the perfect cover for a surprise attack if Washington were nearby. So I am prevented from making good on my bet to William, and he is prevented from coming round to collect his due. 'Tis a small matter of honor, to be sure, but when in reduced circumstances, these things take on greater weight, don't you think?"
Still confuddled, I nodded my head. "Yes, sir."
"Good. Then you'll do it."
"Do what?"
"Take the penny to William with my salutations. It will give him a good laugh. He lives on Chapel Street, a house with red shutters on the corner of Warren. Say you'll do it for me, Giselle, and the next penny I earn goes into your pocket, upon my word."
Madam would be wig-deep in preparations for the ball all day. The soldier wives would, too, for they belonged to the army of servants who would work at the birthday dinner. Lady Seymour required only a warm fire and occasional help with the teacup. A walk up to Warren Street on a sunny day such as this would be most welcome.
"Happy to help, Captain," I said.
The roar of cannon shook the kitchen just after midday and made me near jump out of my skin.
I dropped the turnip I was peeling, and it rolled across the floor.
"What was that?" I asked, clutching the table. "Are we under attack?"
Hannah laughed and used the poker to push the logs to the back of the hearth.
"No, you goose. That's the royal salute for Her Majesty."
Mary pressed the hot iron against the apron on the table.
"Do you figure they might need us early?"
"The major said 5 o'clock, Hannah said. "Gives us time to finish up here."
"Will you get to see the dancing?" I asked.
"Nah," Mary said. "They'll be too busy running us ragged setting up the dinner, but they've promised to feed us good." She picked up the apron and studied it for wrinkles.
"I wish my mother could see this, me, serving at a queen's birthday ball."
"Too bad your mother's on the other side of the globe with Her Majesty," Hannah said. "They'll both be tragical late to the party," Mary giggled. Madam sent a note to her friend Jane Drinkwater, who agreed to bring her collection of necklaces and the latest gossip to tea. The news caused Madam to send the soldier wives pawing through the attic for a gown she had not worn yet this year. Hannah sent me to fetch more water, which I did with great pleasure and a short detour. The houses on Warren Street were a mix. Some were modest, two or three were rather grand, with arches over the windows and fancy boot scrapers by the front door. The trees and fences in the neighborhood had all been cut down for firewood. It made the corner of Warren and Chapel look underdressed. I went round the back of the house with the red shutters, knocked on the door, and explained my errand to a maid who fetched Captain Farrar for me, a horse-faced man with an easy laugh.
"Good Captain Morse is indeed a gentleman," he said as I presented him with the coin. "And you're the girl who carries messages to his men in Bridewell."
"Yes, sir."
"My lads are locked up in the old sugar house," he said, his smile fading.
"The one still alive." He stood there, caught up in silence and his own thoughts. I tried to think of a polite way to take my leave, but could not find the proper words. The breeze came from the south and carried a salt tang with it. Although snow lay about and everyone was wrapped deep in their clothing, the appearance of the clouds made a body know deep down that spring was stirring. "Yes, sir," I finally said, "begging pardon, but I must be on my way."
"Of course, of course,"
he said, his eyes still distant. I walked down the path to Warren Street and stopped when I heard him call me.
"Sal, wait there a moment."
I stood a while longer, watching the clouds and scolding myself for mixing in with the affairs of gentlemen and their honor. Several carriages containing bundled-up ladies and serious-looking officers passed along the street, pulled by shaggy-coated horses. Most folks took no more notice of me than they would a cartman selling oysters or a vagabond from Canvas Town. Just as I set my mind to leave, Captain Farrar came back out.
"Give this to Morse, please,"
he said as he handed me the note.
"He'll know what to do."
I studied the folded paper and made bold. "Another wager, sir?" Another carriage passed on the street, the horses clip-clopping slow. He shook his head, the laughter gone from his eyes.
"No, news from headquarters. Don't tarry with it."
He touched his fingertips to the brim of his cap. I bobbed a curtsy and took my leave, hurrying toward the tea water pump. I should have known I'd be pressed into more message carrying. These soldier types were forever scheming up one thing or another, and it put a girl like me in a rough spot. Not that they ever thought about that. I didn't ask to ferry messages across the city for some captain I didn't know. How was that connected to my deal with Dibden to treat Corps and proper? It wasn't, not one bit. The good captains Morse and Farrar would just have to wait till it suited me for this last message to be delivered. If I didn't get back soon, I'd be in for it. I pushed through the back door to the locked-in kitchen, still fussing about selfish captains who only thought of their own skins. When Corzin got out, he'd have a debt of honor the size of a whale to me. I'd make that boy. I set down the water buckets, removed my cloak, and hung it from a peg near the fire. I stood rubbing my hands together and warming them over the flames. As soon as I could move them, I'd boil up the water. The door from the front hall slammed open.
"There you are!"
The words came at me like shards of glass. I turned. 'Twas Madam Lockton holding a small riding crop in her hand. "Ma'am?" She crossed the room and slashed the crop across my face. It hurt fierce, but I knew not to cry out.
"How dare you!" she spat.
Chapter 43, Saturday, January 18th, 1777. That even a failure cannot be more fatal than to remain in our present situation. In short, some enterprise must be undertaken in our present circumstances, or we must give up the cause. Our affairs are hastening fast to ruin if we do not retrieve them by some happy event. Delay with us is now equal to a total defeat. Colonel Joseph Reed, in a letter to General George Washington.
"Please, ma'am," I started.
"Silence!" She cracked the crop across my shoulder. The back door opened and Hannah entered.
"Oh, excuse me,"
she said, turning to leave again.
"Stay,"
Madam ordered. Hannah let the door close and murmured,
"Yes, madam,"
her eyes stealing once to me, then quickly away.
I fought the urge to run for the knife drawer.
Madam paced in front of me.
"I have never in my entire life been so humiliated."
She paused and put on a mimic face.
"I saw your little black girl talking to a rebel officer on Warren Street. Do you allow your slaves to consort with the enemy?"
I could not swallow nor breathe. She brought the crop down with a crack on the edge of the table.
"Jane Drinkwater said this to me. Jane Drinkwater, the biggest gossip in New York."
Madam paced again, her hair flying loose, her manner quite unsteady.
"I said, 'No, Jane, you must be mistaken, not our Sal. Colonel Hawkins himself uses her for errands.'"
She stopped suddenly.
"And Jane says, 'No, Anne, your girl was speaking to a rebel prisoner on Warren Street. It's hard to miss the mark on her face. From my carriage, I saw her take a note from his hand.'"
I opened my mouth to protest, but she slashed at me again. This time, the blow opened a cut on my forehead.
"Give me that note," Madam demanded.
"I have no note, ma'am," I said quiet.
She held out her hand.
"Liar! Give me that paper or I'll turn you over to the British commander so fast your fool head will spin."
Her voice shook with rage. I reached into my pocket and pulled out the folded note. Madam looked over to Hannah.
"See, you just need to be firm with them."
Hannah said nothing. A drop of blood rolled down the side of my face. I clutched the note in my fist.
"Give it."
Madam narrowed her eyes. "Did you hear me, girl?" Everybody carried a little evil in them, Mama once told me. Madam Lockton had more than her share. The poison had eaten holes through her soul and made room for vermin to nest inside her.
"Girl!"
Madam stamped her foot on the floor. The evil inside of me woke and crackled like lightning. I could wrap my hands around her throat. I could brain her with a poker, thrust her face into the flames. I could beat her senseless with my fist. I shook from the effort of holding myself still, clutching the crumpled paper. Mama said we had to fight the evil inside us by overcoming it with goodness. She said it was a hard thing to do, but it made us worthy. I breathed deep to steady myself. I threw the captain's note into the fire. Hannah gasped. Madam shrieked and pushed me out of the way, but the paper was already alight. She dropped the crop and smacked me again in the face with her hand, as she had the day I first landed in New York.
"You foul, bloody wench!"
She reached behind her, picked up a bowl, and hurled it at me. I ducked, and it crashed against the hearth.
"I will sell you," she screamed. "I will auction you at dawn on Monday. I'll sell your demon sister, too, to the most cruel, heartless master I can find, the devil himself, if he wants."
She paused to catch her breath.
"Ruth?"
Hannah stepped forward.
"I do believe there was a knock at the front door, madam," she said. "But she already sold Ruth."
Madam glared at her.
"Then answer it, you bloody fool."
"Didn't she?"
As Hannah left, Madam brushed back her hair, gathering her dignity. I still stood by the fire where the note had burned to fine ash. I could not think what might happen next. Madam tugged at her short gown.
"What's that stupid look on your face?"
she said with a harsh laugh.
"You didn't know I still owned her, did you?"
"Ruth?"
The name escaped my mouth.
"Brat," Madam spat. "Couldn't find a buyer. Had to ship her down to Charleston. I should tell the estate manager to get rid of her. Toss her in the swamp. Her death will be on your head, you insolent fool.
Hannah came back in from the hall.
The hairdresser, madam.
What?
Madam wheeled about.
What did you say?
The hairdresser's come to prepare you for the ball. The Queen's ball, ma'am. You must leave in a few hours.
Madam cleared her throat and stood straighter.
Of course. You must first help me into my gown.
Hannah nodded.
Yes, ma'am.
Lock the girl in the potato bin, then come upstairs.
The bin was more than half filled with potatoes and smelled of damp earth and worms. There was not enough room to sit up, but lying down was like lying in a bed of rocks. I wanted to scream and pinch myself hard to fight the urge. I did not want to give Madam any satisfaction. Overhead came the noises of footsteps as the hairdresser performed his job and left, and the colonel returned from headquarters to change into his dress uniform, and Madam sent Hannah running for this folderol and that. There was the sound of horse hooves and the roll of carriage wheels, and the front door opened and then closed, and the house fell quiet, save for Hannah's steps in the kitchen. A light appeared through the boards of the bin.
It's me, Hannah said. She's gone.
The light was set on the ground. Then there was a fumbling of a key in the padlock. The bin door opened, and Hannah peered in.
I brought you some things. Here.
She handed me a chamber pot, a blanket, and a mug of water.
Tain't right to lock you away with nothing. You ain't an animal.
Let me go, please, I pleaded. But before I could say anything further or reach for her, she had slammed down the door and shot home the lock again.
I'll be back by dawn and check on you then, she said. Try to sleep.
Please, Hannah, I cried. Please, I beg of you. Her footsteps flew up the stairs and the door slammed. I thought I heard a sob, but perhaps I didn't. The bees overtook me then. As evening moved into night, they ate through me and hived up inside my brain pan with a loud buzz, their wings beating me into submission. Someone whimpered and cried, and it must have been me, but it mattered not, for I was already dead. It was only a few days, hours perhaps, until my heart would stop beating, in truth, and the bees would fly off to haunt someone else. And then came the sound of a distant roar, like a lion just sprung from a trap. The bees paused, and I froze, waiting. No one was home except for Lady Seymour, and she was not capable of making noise. The roar came again. I cocked my head and listened. It did not come from the street nor the house above. It was not cannon fire. T'was inside me. A thought. Thunderous, loud. Ruth was alive! Alive in Charleston! In South Carolina, not on a ship, not on an island. Alive in a town I can walk to! My toes wiggled in my sturdy black shoes and my legs itched. I lay flat as I could on the bumpy mound of potatoes and kicked once at the boards of the bin. My heavy shoes made a terrible loud noise in the wood. I stopped, counted to 100. There came no sound from overhead, no commotion out on the street. I kicked again at the same spot. The potatoes under me shifted and the mug of water overturned. I kicked a third time. The boards did not move at all. I cursed the carpenter who had built this tomb. There has to be a way out. I kicked, stomped, slammed. I raged and screamed and fought. Nothing happened. I stopped, wiped the sweat from my face and closed my eyes. Think. The bin stood a little taller than Ruth and was as long in both directions as it was tall. I reached up to touch the boards above my head. They were rough-hewn, put together with cold nails. My fingertips traced the length of each board, feeling along the splinters and the knots in the wood. The top was as solid as a brick wall, each nail fastened tight. I fought back the panic that rose in my throat and tested the strength of each board that ran from the top down the sides. All strong, all sound. Think. Remember. When Ruth and I slept down here, the far corner of the cellar went muddy in a heavy rain. Maybe the damp had eaten at the boards. I moved over to that corner of the bin and scooped the potatoes out of the way, heaping them behind me. I sat back and put my feet on each board in turn and pushed. The third board I tried gave way a little. So did the next two. I moved the potato heap so I could best lean against it and push with my legs. I kicked. There was a quiet crack. I kicked again and leaned forward to feel the boards. The one had a piece chipped off where the wood was rotted through. The other had a long split in it. I leaned back and took a deep breath. Then kicked and kicked with all my strength until the wood broke and flew into the dark. I took the stairs two at a time and paused before I entered the kitchen. The house was still silent. I hurried down the hall, past the grandfather clock, and up the stairs to the drawing room. I needed a map and had a mind to steal a pass, too, if I could. I threw some wood on the fire, lit a candle from the flames, and carried it to the long dining table covered with maps and countless papers. I lit the rest of the candles on the table as if preparing for a feast, then searched through the papers, throwing those that were useless to me to the floor. Finally, I found a small map that showed the colonies from Massachusetts down to Georgia. The distance from Rhode Island to New York was the same as the tip of my little finger to the first knuckle under it. From New York to Charleston stretched all the way down my fingers to the palm. The crackling firewood startled me. I glanced up. There was a movement over the hearth, and for an instant, my heart caught in my throat. A ghost? The firelight brightened. No, not a ghost. I had caught sight of myself in the large mirror that hung over the mantel. I could scarce recognize me. My hands fumbled for a candle. I moved to the mirror, guarding the flame, and lit the oil lamps that were set into the wall. The mirror caught the light and reflected it back at me. I leaned in. In truth, it seemed I was looking at a stranger who lived beyond the glass. My face was thinner than I remembered, and longer from brow to chin. My nose and mouth recollected Mama's, but the set of eyes, those came from Papa. As I stared, their two faces came forth and drifted back, until I could see only me. I turned my head to the side a bit and studied the brand on my face. For the first time, studied it hard. The capital I that proclaimed my insolent manners and crimes. I leaned closer to the mirror. The letter was a pink ribbon embroidered on my skin. I touched it, smooth and warm, flesh made into silk. The scars on Papa's cheeks had been three lines across his cheek carved with a sharp blade. He was proud of his marks. In the country of his ancestors, they made him into a man. I traced the eye with my fingertip. This is my country mark. I did not ask for it, but I would carry it as Papa carried his. It made me his daughter. It made me strong. I took a step back, seeing near my whole self in the mirror. I pushed back my shoulders and raised my chin, my back straight as an arrow. This mark stands for Isabel. The clock struck 11 and made me jump. I had much to do and little time. The fastest way off the island was a boat, much as the thought made me tremble. I searched through the sea of papers on the table until I found a chart of the tides. I ran my finger down the columns. Huzzah! The tide would not turn against me for a few hours. I lacked only a pass. Colonel Hawkins had been in the habit of keeping them locked in the chest in the library. But he had become sloppy and overworked since the rebel victories. I opened the drawers of the secretary table and looked through the large boxes of official papers. There! I grabbed the paper and dashed to a small side table for a quill and bottle of ink. I crowded the candles in close together to give me enough light, took a deep breath to steady my hand, and dipped the quill. I took a second breath and bent over to fill in the empty bits of the pass. New York, blank space, 1777. I wrote in 18th, January, in the blank space. It had been some time since I wrote out letters. The J wobbled, and the R appeared to be an N. I set down the quill, wiped my damp hands on my skirt, and picked it up again. This is to certify, to whomsoever it may concern, that the bearer hereof, blank space.
That was where I had to write my name. I scratched out Isabel and stopped. I was not a Lockton nor a Finch. Isabel, Rhode Island? That would not do. Isabel Cuffy after Papa? Or Isabel Dinah after Mama? I closed my eyes and thought of home, the smell of fresh-cut hay and the taste of raspberries, robins chasing bugs in the bean patch, setting worms to work at the base of the corn plants, showing Ruth what was weed and what was flower. I opened my eyes, dipped the quill, and wrote out my true name. Isabel Gardner, being a free Negro, has the commandant's permission to pass from this garrison to whatever place she may think proper. It was signed with lots of fancy titles that belonged to the colonel and the commandant and the king himself. I wish that there would have been space for Her Majesty, Queen Charlotte of Great Britain, to sign it too. She and me shared a birthday now, for I was reborn as Isabel Gardner, and that paper proved it.
Chapter 44, Saturday, January 18th, 1777. That the question was not whether, by a declaration of independence, we should make ourselves what we are not, but whether we should declare a fact which already exists. Thomas Jefferson about the writing of the Declaration of Independence. I folded the map and pass, blew out the candles, and crept down the stairs. I took the scissors out of the sewing basket in the kitchen and snipped the threads of the hem of my cloak. I opened the map flat, inserted it between the lining and the woolen layer, then quick resewed the hem. Next, I dressed myself in all of my clothing, two shifts and two skirts, my cloak, shawl, and the blanket from my pallet. I took a basket from a high shelf and loaded it with bread, hard cheese, and a piece of dried beef I cut from the slab that hung in the pantry. As I put the beef back, I studied the loose board in the back of the pantry. I pried it up and removed the lead piece from the king's statue and my cloth packet of seeds. After some consideration, I took out common sense, too, and stuck all of it in the pocket I wore under my skirt alongside the false pass. I walked down the hall, reached for the handle of the front door, and stopped. Lady Seymour lay in the silent parlor. I doubted anyone had thought to put wood on the fire for her. That was my chore. No, not anymore. I was quit of this place. I reached again for the handle. But she was alone, old, and maybe freezing. It would take only an instant. I stepped into the parlor. Lady Seymour lay in her bed, her eyes closed, the covers barely moving. Her fire was near burned down to ash. I quick added logs and blew on the coals until small flames jumped up and bit into the wood. She wouldn't die of the cold this night, not on my account. I was halfway to the door when I saw her silk reticule hung from the back of a chair. There were coins in that bag, coins that would help a girl set on walking to South Carolina. But that was stealing from somebody who had showed me kindness. But she stood by when Ruth was taken, and she returned me to Madam. But taking her money was still stealing. 'Twas wrong, but I swallowed hard, opened the bag, and removed the coin purse from the bottom. When I hung it back on the chair, Lady Seymour's eyes were open and following me. The question on her face was plain. "I'm sorry," I said. "She's made up her mind to sell me." She nodded once. I built up the fire. "Would you like some water?" She nodded again. I poured a cup of water from the pitcher and held it to her dry lips. She swallowed a little, but the rest spilled down her face. I set down the cup and wiped away the water. "I have to go. Please forgive me." Lady Seymour cut her eyes at her husband's small portrait on the bedside table, then to the coin purse that weighed down my hand. She gave a sharp nod of the head. One side of her mouth turned up in a smile. "I'll put the money back," I said. "Forgive me." She shook her head from side to side, her mouth moving with trapped words. "I can keep it?" Another nod, and another pointed stare at her husband. "Because I rescued his picture?" She nodded again, and a tear slipped down her cheek. "Well then, ma'am, I'm happy to take it." As I set the coin purse in my pocket, she opened her mouth and a small sound escaped. Did you say something, Lady Seymour? I leaned in close, though it scared me, for the smell of death hung over that bed like a fog. Her lips moved again, forming her last word to me, a whisper almost too faint to hear. Run! I opened the front door of the Lockton mansion and looked up the street and down, not a soul in sight. I picked up the basket, tightened the blanket across my shoulders, and stepped over the threshold. I closed the door behind me, walked down the front steps, and turned west. My plan was simple and foolhardy. Steal a rowboat, cross the river to Jersey, and walk to Charleston. I was counting on the commotion of the Queen's Ball to distract folks. If I could get to the boat in time, the tide would help pull me away from New York. At the first corner, my feet stopped. This was where I turned north most mornings to head up to the Bridewell. I urged my feet west toward the wharf. They did not listen. My memory called up the feel of being locked in the stocks, of my face being burnt, of him watching me from across the courtyard, him watching out for me. 'Twas Corzine who made sure I survived. 'Twas he who had been my steadfast friend since the day they brought me here. I couldn't. It would be hard enough to sneak past two armies and not get stolen again by someone who would tear up my pass. And I didn't even have a pass for him. How to explain that? No, I couldn't. I looked west, toward the river, then north, then west again. No, not couldn't. I shouldn't. But I had to. I had a debt to pay. Good evening, sir, I said, holding out my basket to the huge soldier, Fisher, who opened the door to the Bridewell guardhouse. Fisher grunted and yawned. What's your business here? It's going on midnight. I prayed that the Lord and Mama would forgive the river of lies about to flow from my mouth. Colonel Hawkins sent me, sir, to clean the cells as you suggested. The guard stepped inside, and I followed him. He sat heavily in a chair and drank from a mug on the table. Terrible late to be cleaning cells. The colonel got wind of a prison inspector arriving. Nobody told me, he growled. I swallowed hard. Should I flee and give up on this senseless plot? He spat into the fire. But they don't tell me nothing. What's in the basket? Food to keep me alive for a week, I thought. Help yourself, I said. He pawed through it, took out a soft roll and stuffed half of it in his mouth. Maybe I should ask the colonel, I thought quick as I could. Yes, sir, of course. He's at the Queen's Ball. Fisher winced. Best not disturb that. All right. He stood slow and reached for the key ring and a lantern on the wall. But don't be asking me to help. Cleaning the cells ain't my job. I took the key. Yes, sir. Wheelbarrow's in the hall, he said. Once you filled it, roll it back here and I'll let you out so you can throw the muck and filth in the pit. He yawned. Mind your breathing. I turned. Pardon? Prisoner's been dropping dead like flies. Fever. The men in the first cell were mostly sleeping, or dying, or dead. None of them had the strength to do more than stare at me in the weak lantern light. I gagged and gagged again as I carried out overflowing chamber pots and forced myself to take a blanket from a corpse. Hurry, I screamed inside. Hurry, or it will be too late. Fisher looked up and chuckled as I passed back through the guardhouse with the barrel. I pitched the filth into the pit behind the prison and prayed it was not going to top any corpses. Before I went back inside, I cleaned off my hands in a snowbank. My teeth rattled with the cold. No fun, is it? The guard asked as I passed through again. He pulled at the blanket around his shoulders. Hurry up now. I need me sleep. Yes, sir. I wiped my hands on my skirt. Almost done, sir. I did not open the door to the second cell, nor the third. I set the lantern in the wheelbarrow, pushed it down the hall to the fourth door on the right, and held my breath as I unlocked it. The stench was overpowering. Men unwashed for months and puke and muck and rot that was eating living flesh. 2 dozen pairs of eyes watched me, burning in skull-like faces. No one spoke. I stepped inside and held the lantern higher. The faces were new to me. Men and boys who had been moved in here after Corzine's original companions died. "Where's Mr. Dibden?" I asked in a small voice.
"Died this morning," croaked a man. "Everyone's dying."
"What about the slave boy?" He pointed to a corner. Corzine lay insensible, his skin burning with fever, his eyes rolled up into his head. I called his name and pinched him, but he did not look my way nor speak a word. "He'll be dead soon. Leave him and run." A weight settled on my shoulders like a cloak of iron. I bent close to his ear. "Shh," I whispered. A blast of cannon fire sounded from the battery. More royal celebrations. A few men looked to the window. "He's dead." I stood up. "Can someone help me with the body?" No one moved. "Then I shall do it myself." I grabbed Corzine under his armpits and dragged him across the floor and out the door. It took no effort at all to load him into the wheelbarrow. He weighed hardly more than a sack of potatoes or a full butter churn. I dashed back into the cell, snatched his hat out of the shaking hands of a man who was putting it on his own head, grabbed the lantern, and closed and locked the cell door. I could not ponder the fate of the rest of the men. Some things were not to be borne. Before I pushed him down the hall and into the guardhouse, I covered Corzine with the filthy blanket I'd stolen from the first cell. "You're dead," I hissed to him. "No noise." In the guardhouse, Fisher was sitting on his bed, leaning against the wall and snoring. He roused some as I shut the door to the cells. "Got a nasty load here," I said. "Might take a bit to bury it." He nodded, already half asleep. As I pushed the wheelbarrow into the night, my legs shook so hard I thought sure they'd set the earth to trembling and bring the whole building crashing to the ground.
Chapter 45. Saturday, January 18th through Sunday, January 19th, 1777. Everything that is right or reasonable pleads for separation. The blood of the slain, the weeping voice of nature cries, "'Tis time to part." Thomas Paine, Common Sense. The prison was 10 blocks from the wharf. I covered the first 8 blocks as fast as a girl pushing a near-dead lump of a boy could. Then I stopped. A sentry fire was lit at the corner, burning between us and the last 2 blocks to the wharf. 6 British guards stood warming their hands, their muskets leaning against the small pile of firewood. A dog lay at their feet, head resting on his front paws. One of the men stretched his arms over his head and gave a mighty yawn, and his companions laughed at him. The dog lifted his head once and looked in our direction, but a soldier reached down to scratch his ears and he relaxed. If I tried to push the wheelbarrow over the cobblestones, we'd be arrested in an instant. If it were half an hour earlier, we could have tracked backward and gone down another street, but the tide wouldn't wait. I backed up, slow as I could, cringing with every creak of the wheels. Once we were well out of sight of the men, I pulled the blanket off Corzine. "Get up," I whispered as I helped him from the barrel. "We need to get past those soldiers. After that, it's only 2 blocks to the river." "Boat?" he asked, leaning against the wall. "Of course. Follow me. Stay close." He took one step forward and collapsed against me, the two of us crumpling to the ground. "No," I scolded as I stood and pulled him to his feet. "You have to try harder." "Sorry, country," he muttered. He was not strong enough to walk on his own. I was not strong enough to carry him on my back, not after pushing him so far. I pulled his arm across my shoulder and had him lean on me heavily. "Step quiet," I whispered as we drew close to the corner again. 20 paces of open street separated us from the shadows on the other side. One of the soldiers walked to the woodpile, picked up a split log, carried it to the fire, and tossed it on the flames. For the moment, all the men had their backs to us. "Ready?" I said in Corzine's ear. He nodded. I drew a deep breath, and we started to walk, soft as we could. 20 paces stretched 20 miles. Every faint crunch of our shoes sounded like gunshot. 5 steps, I counted silently. 6, 7. Corzine had little strength in his legs. He faltered and almost fell again. I wrapped my other arm around him and clutched his shirt. 8, 9, 10. The dog lifted his head. He stared right at me and barked.
One of the soldiers, startled, shouted,
"Look at that!"
and pointed to the sky. The heavens exploded into the red glare of rockets and white fountains of light. Corzin and I stood as if planted, amazed at the sight of the fireworks being shot off in honor of Queen Charlotte. The dog barked furiously in our direction, but the soldiers were all staring at the illuminations above. The noise rolled up, booms that sounded like thunder and cannons. The men all smiled and laughed at the spectacle. I dragged Corzin across the street and down the last two blocks to the wharf. It was dark, no watch posted, as I had hoped. "Thank you, Mama," I muttered as we crawled into a rowboat. Corzin groaned.
"What do you say?"
I untied us from the wharf. "Never mind." But he was already insensible again. I picked up the oars. I rode that river. I rode that river like it was a horse delivering me from the devil. My hands blistered, the blisters popped. They reformed and popped again. I rolled with my hands slick with blood. My back, my shoulders, my arms, they pulled with the strength of 1,000 armloads of firewood split and carried, of water buckets toted for miles, of the burdens of every New York day and New York night boiled into 2 miles of water that I was going to cross. Set after set of the Queen's fireworks exploded over the roofs of the city, over Canvas Town, over the mansions that held the King's subjects in their ball gowns and fancy dress uniforms. Her fireworks blasted off, and everybody gazed into the sky, and I rode and rode and rode past their homes, aside their warehouses, underneath their cannons, and out into the open harbor betwixt New York Island and Jersey. My wits wandered some, about the time my hands started bleeding. Tongues of fog oozed across the water and curled around the bits of ice that floated past. I saw in the fog the forms of people. They never came close enough that I could see their faces. Once I reached out, feeling a warm presence, but I near tipped the boat over and had to grab for the oar before it slid away. My hands plunged into the icy water, and I rowed and rowed, but it didn't hurt after that because my hands had froze. I rowed and the tide pulled, and the ghost, who could indeed travel over water, tugged my boat with all their strength. My eyes closed and the moon drew me west, away from the island of my melancholy. When my eyes opened, I knew I had died and passed on to glory. Heaven was crystal lit with white angel fire, colored peach at the edges. Heaven smelled of wood smoke. I blinked. The Bible did not mention that heaven smelled of wood smoke. I blinked again. When I opened my eyes, they watered because of the bright morning light. The rowboat had come ashore in a tangle of bushes that overhung a small bank at the side of the river. The branches overhead were all coated in ice. I was coated in ice, too, that fractured and crackled as I moved. I looked to the water, then to the rising sun, then to the water again. I looked around me. No houses, no ships, no wharves. The river was narrow and flowing out to sea, south. The sun rose beyond the water, at the other side of the river. I was on the west bank. I was in Jersey. I had set myself free. I wiped at the water that flowed down my cheeks and kicked at the stinking bundle at the bottom of the boat. "You alive?" I asked. The bundle groaned and pushed aside the shredded blanket. Corzin lifted his head enough to look at me sitting there with a full grin on my face. "Where are we?" he asked in a thin voice. "I think we just crossed the River Jordan." I stood up, steadied myself as the boat rocked a bit, and offered him my hand. "Can you walk?" We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Chains by Laurie Halts Anderson. Copyright 2008 by Laurie Halts Anderson. Read by Madison Lee. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Troy Harrison. Performance copyright 2008 Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliantaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form.
It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.